mechanism has been tried before, right? And so what's the new ingredient here is the fact that the standard model is restricted to your brain? Is that what's new in the ADD mechanism?
Yeah, so suppose I look at a five-dimensional graviton, HMN. I can reduce this into four dimensional components, H mu nu, H mu a, and H a a.
Right.
And the original Kaluza-Klein idea was to identify this with a graviton, identify this with a photon,
right,
and try to deal with this later. That doesn't end up working. First of all, we know we have more gauge forces, and we also know that they don't fit nicely into the structure. But the new ingredient that was used for large extra dimensions, or ADD, was this idea of localizing certain fields of the theory in certain parts of an extra dimension. So specifically for the ADD case, you have these large extra dimensions, but the standard model doesn't travel on them. The standard model is confined to a four-dimensional subspace of this bigger space. And this is something that was inspired by essentially discovery of deep brains and so on in string theory, where in the stringy context, you found these objects on which you could localize certain fields of the theory. So that was the motivation for this large extra dimensions picture, which admittedly is very simplified compared to the full string story, but as a low energy effective theory, it holds together. Okay, so I guess let me get started. And let me just say a few last things about large extra dimensions before turning to warped extra dimensions. So remember, the thing with large extra dimensions is that we have d equals 4 plus n dimensional spacetime. And we'll write the extra dimensions as WA. A is equal to 1, 2, up to n. And the standard model is confined to a four-dimensional subspace at WA equal to 0 for all A's. And gravity necessarily propagates everywhere. And we assume that these extra dimensions are periodic. Let me just write this one. Are periodic with radius r. So in other words, we identify WA with WA 2 pi r. So if I have one extra dimension, the picture is the standard model lives at WA equals to 0, and then the rest of the W space would just be a circle. And then the radius of the circle is just r. So the nice thing about this story is that the effective Planck scale that we see is reduced relative to the fundamental Planck scale by a volume factor. So we have so the n-dimensional volume of the extra dimensions goes like r to the n, or actually I guess I should say it's 2 pi r to the power of n. But what's happening is this is the Planck scale we see. This is the fundamental Planck scale, or the fundamental scale of gravity. And we can arrange for this to be about near the TeV, provided this r is relatively big. And by big r, I mean if I look at inverse r is typically much, much less than, let's say, the GeV scale. And sometimes it can be even sort of EV scale. So when we take gravity and allow gravity to travel in the extra dimension, but confine the standard model here, we find that we get, as physical excitations, the interesting ones for the most part are we get back our regular graviton as a massless zero mode, but we also get KK gravitons. And these KK gravitons, I'll parameterize them by n, couple to the energy momentum tensor of the standard model with strength 1 over m Planck. When you put in all the factors. So the new things in this theory are these KK gravitons. And the form of this coupling can allow things of the following form. So one coupling this allows is one KK graviton to typically a pair of standard model fields. So one way you can look for this signal is you can look for these KK gravitons at colliders. And remember, the mass splitting between the KK gravitons, the relative mass splitting goes like R inverse. So these KK gravitons are very closely spaced. And since they're very closely spaced and the spacing is much less than GeV, you have a whole tower of them that in principle we could access at a high energy collider. So for example, you could look at creating KK gravitons through a process where, let's say I have a pair of gluons colliding from a proton-proton collision. Here's a gluon, here's an outgoing gluon, and I can imagine producing KK gravitons at colliders this way. So what this would look like in my final state, so this is my initial state from a PP collision, this final state would have one gluon coming out and one KK graviton. And the KK graviton is going to correspond to missing energy, the so-called missing ET. Because this thing is stable and it just flies off, you don't see it in your detector. And this thing, this gluon, turns into a QCD jet. So one of the signals of this KK graviton theory in large extra dimensions is you look for signals of, let's say at the LHC or other collider, of a jet plus missing ET. And in particular, you'd typically expect one hard jet, so one energetic jet from this main collision recoiling against nothing. So you look in your detector, you see one jet and nothing on the other side, and that's a characteristic signal of this. So now, if you go back and you look at the coupling, this doesn't look so good. Because the strength of this coupling goes like 1 over M Planck. So this cross-section is going to go like, naively, 1 over M Planck squared. And this doesn't look so good. But the thing is that this is a cross-section for only a single KK graviton. Whereas these states are very closely spaced. And in principle, I have kinematic access to a lot of different ones. So instead of just looking at a single KK graviton, I should sum over all modes, at least up to the energies I have access to. And when I do this sum, so where I sum over the cross-section to produce a given KK graviton modes that I parameterize by n, when I do this sum, I end up with cross-sections that end up being on the order of 1 over m star squared, which looks like 1 over TeV squared, and this is accessible experimentally. So the net signal you'd expect at the collider from large extra dimensions is you never resolve individual KK gravitons, but it's a net signal from all the possible KK graviton possibilities. So you sum over all these individual cross-sections, and they add up to something that ends up being measurable. And people have gone off and looked for this signal. And from the LHC data, you got limits on the order of, I guess if you translate it into the M star scale, M star greater than a few TeV. So this is one way to constrain this large extra dimensional scenario. Another way you can constrain it, and this is more indirect, but another thing that can happen, at least for smaller n, the smaller the n, the bigger the radius you need, and correspondingly the lighter the KK gravitons. And for relatively light KK gravitons, when your masses are less than about 30 MeV, this can have interesting effects on stellar processes, the natural physical processes. And one of the best constraints comes from looking at supernova. So there's a very famous 1987A supernova, happened in 1987. And this supernova was interesting because what happened is it was seen first in neutrinos, and then it was seen later from its light signal. So first a flash of neutrinos was seen in neutrino detectors, and then later on light from the supernova was seen. Like, you see the supernova. And the way this happens is that a supernova is, very roughly, it's a star that's exploding. And the medium around the star is so dense that light can't get out for a long time. But neutrinos can get out. So you expect neutrinos to escape from the supernova at early times, and then light's only able to escape at some later time. So you have these later photons. And because we saw the neutrino signal before the light, this tells us what happened in terms of the supernova. And it also tells us how quickly the supernova cooled off. So essentially, the thing that restricts the photons from getting out is the temperature of the system. And while the supernova envelope remains hot enough, the photons just bang into the plasma and they don't get out. So you have to wait for the supernova to cool enough for the photons to get out. Now, if you have another source of cooling for the supernova, the photons would be able to get out earlier, and we would have seen them earlier than we saw. So what can happen with KK gravitons is that the temperature inside the supernova very early on is something like 30 MeV. When it first starts going off. And if you have new light particles, even if they're fairly weakly coupled, if you have new light particles, they can be produced in the thermal collisions you'd expect in this plasma. And if you had KK gravitons, in principle, the KK gravitons could also get out. And these KK gravitons, they get out. They don't interact very much, so they'd act like neutrinos or even better. They get out, and they'd help cool off the supernova. And even though each individual KK graviton couples very weakly, you have a lot of them. And this could be a big supernova cooling mechanism, and it would have changed what we saw for the supernova 1987A. And based on this, depending on what the value of n is, for n equals 2, you get something like m star greater than sort of order, I think, 10 TeV. And then for n equals 3, I have it written down in my notes, it's something like 2 TeV. And then it gets weaker for larger n. But on top of these collider constraints, you also have interesting astrophysical constraints on this large extra dimensional scenario. But for now, that's all I want to say. And I want to change gears now and look at a very different realization of extra dimensions. It's often called the Randall-Sundrum scenario, after Randall and Sundrum, who came up with it. But one very interesting thing about the Randall-Sundrum scenario is that you can think of it as a simplified model for either certain configurations that come out of string theory, or possibly an equivalent so-called dual description of certain strongly coupled gauge theories. So for now, I'm just going to treat it as a simple effect of five-dimensional theory. I'll get to it in a second. But later on, if I have time, probably tomorrow, I'll say a few words about how it might connect to certain classes of strongly coupled gauge theories. OK. So the Randall-Sundrum scenario or RS is based on a five-dimensional spacetime. And the structure of this five-dimensional spacetime is that the fifth dimension is of finite extent, and it has two boundaries. So if we call our extra-dimensional coordinate w, the w goes from 0 to what I'll call pi rc. So this is the w direction. And then this is the fifth dimension. And then at every point along here, I have a regular four-dimensional spacetime. And the metric of the space is said to be warped. And what I mean by this is the metric of the space takes the following form. So for any fixed value of w, in the extra dimension, in terms of this coordinate, it's locally flat. But as I move along the w direction, I have a rescaling of this relative strength compared to this. And we call this piece a warp factor. And this means that physics here looks different from physics here in an important way. So this geometry is different from what we had before. First of all, we just have an interval with these so-called boundaries. But then on top of that, we have a net curvature. So it turns out that this k corresponds to a curvature in the fifth dimension. And for this reason, we sometimes call K the curvature. And it's in a GR sense, you can compute the curvature of this space-time, and it coincides with the K. Now, we have these finite boundaries. And we usually call these boundaries, we call this one the UV brain. And we call this one the IR brain. And the intuitive picture that I'm going to try to convey to you is that, in a sense, on the UV brain, things look like you have a very high effective Planck scale, whereas on the IR brain, it looks like you have a very low effective Planck scale. And the UV and IR will hopefully make sense in a minute. OK, so I'm just giving you a background spacetime, but it turns out that this background spacetime is consistent with Einstein's equations with a few inputs. So it's a solution to Einstein's equations. With so if in my five-dimensional theory I write down a cosmological constant in the bulk in the so-called intermediate region, so okay, just the terminology is this fifth-dimensional region is called the bulk. If I put in a 5D cosmological constant in my theory. With regular classical gravity, this is a solution provided I tune the tensions of these brains that also contribute to net energy density of the system in a special way. And the tuning corresponds to having effectively a zero net cosmological constant, or an almost zero net cosmological constant in the four-dimensional effective theory. So in other words, you can have a pretty big cosmological constant in the 5D theory, but what we really care about is at long distances in our four-dimensional effective theory, the effective cosmological constant is close to zero, because this is what we see. And it turns out that you can get there with non-trivial five-dimensional cosmological constant, provided you have a warp factor. So the thing you're getting, the thing that gives us geometry beyond just flat extra dimensions is this five-dimensional cosmological constant plus brain tensions. Okay, so this is self-consistent.
What do you mean by brain tension?
So each brain, each four-dimensional boundary has an energy per unit area associated with it. And energy per unit area is what we call tension. So this source is gravity. This energy per unit area. This source is gravity. So you have to include it in the Einstein equations.
And is that a RS spacetime is vacuum solution? With the cosmological constant.
It's a vacuum solution in that it's the lowest energy configuration given these constraints. Okay. So what else? OK, just one more comment. We've written this as a classical solution, a classical solution of a classical GR. And we're going to introduce in a second a fundamental Planck scale, or fundamental gravity scale. And the natural value for the curvature is on the order of this fundamental Planck scale, as is the bulk cosmological constant and the brain tensions. We're going to make a slight assumption that the K over M star is just a little bit less than 1. Not a whole lot less than 1, but a little bit less than 1, because otherwise our curvature is on the order of the fundamental Planck scale, and we have to worry about quantum gravity stuff. So at least to the extent that we can get away with having a curvature that's slightly smaller compared to the fundamental Planck scale, we can trust this and treat it as a mostly classical system. Okay, so this is just a comment as I go along. OK. So the way this warping is going to address the hierarchy problem is that it's going to take our fundamental Planck scale, and it's going to, in a sense, warp it down to a much smaller value on the IR brain. And this warping is going to correspond to this warp factor. So to see this, I need to do two things. The first is, let's take this theory and look at the effect of 4D Planck scale. So in other words, suppose I look at the theory at large distances with a fundamental Planck scale m star, what do I see as the effect of Planck scale? So the starting point for this is I write down my gravitational action. And my gravitational action in five dimensions with a fundamental Planck scale has the following form. And then I have my usual root g. And then I have my five-dimensional Ricci scalar. So this is my five-dimensional gravity theory. And let's focus on configurations where I only look at fluctuations in the four-dimensional part of the metric. So in other words, let's look at configurations of the following form. So put another way, I'm not allowing fluctuations in these off-diagonal pieces or in the five-dimensional. So actually, this should be minus 1. And I take this. And it turns out, OK, well, given this form, and going back to what I had over here, this g mu nu is just e to the minus 2kw times something I'll call g bar mu nu. So in the limit of in the limit of flat space time, it's just a to mu nu. So this g bar mu nu matches up with what we would identify as the flat space limit. But if we allow fluctuations around this, this will give us gr. So this g mu nu and this g mu nu is depending on x. So we can take this. And we can plug it into our gravity equation. And you can show, with a bit of fiddling, that my root g, g5, is equal to minus g bar, with a four-dimensional root g scalar, e to the minus 2kw. So constraining my five-dimensional metric to look like this, I can show that my gravity, the piece that goes in the action, reduces to the piece that would go in the action for a regular 4D theory of gravity. So this is my effective 4D Ricci scalar. This is my usual root g. But I get this extra warp factor. And this extra warp factor comes from the obvious place here. So we take this, we plug it in here, and we'll identify by this with the usual 4D Einstein-Hilbert action, but we're going to get some extra numerical factors. So let me do that next. Actually, I think I can do it here. So I take this, I plug it in here. All this stuff only depends on x. So the only w dependence comes in this. And then I just have to do the dw integral. And when I work through this, what I find is m star cubed over 2k times 1 minus e to the minus 2 pi krc times the usual 4d Einstein-Hilbert action. So all I'm doing here is looking at fluctuations of the metric that have the form of four-dimensional graviton fluctuations. I plug it back into my gravity theory. And this is the usual Einstein-Hilbert 4D Einstein-Hilbert action. And this thing is what I would identify as m Planck squared over 2. So in other words, my effective 4D Planck scale it's just m star q over k, 1 minus e to the minus 2 pi krc. And this exponential correction, we're going to look at limits where krc is about 10. So that this exponential is completely tiny. So we don't have to worry about negligible. We don't have to worry about this exponential. So my m Planck squared is roughly m star cubed over k. So m star is our fundamental Planck scale. K is a curvature scale in the extra dimension. And I've argued that we want to consider k to be slightly less than m star, but still in the same ballpark. So the upshot of all this is that the fundamental Planck scale and the curvature scale are both on the order of the Planck scale in this warp geometry. So we don't get this volume dilution like we did in the large extra dimension. And okay, just to warn you, recall that my definition of the Planck scale is a reduced value corresponding to the roughly 10 to the 18 GeV. Just for reference. Okay, there's another definition that has a root 8 pi that's more like 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay, in any case, I see that in my warp geometry, my fundamental Planck scale looks a lot like my regular Planck scale, and there's no big dilution, there's no sense of volume dilution or so on. So, okay, so at this point, things look fairly straightforward, but the story becomes interesting when I think about putting confining fields to the IR brain. Yeah.
Where in this expression do we have the input that we are on the IR brain or the EV brain? This is independent of that, right?
This is independent of that.
We could be anywhere in the geometry.
So in general, I'm going to come back and discuss how to put the standard model into the story. And there are essentially two ways to put the standard model in. The first puts all the standard model on the IR brain. And the second puts all the standard model in the bulk, except for the Higgs, which still lives on the IR brain. So we typically want the Higgs to live in the IR brain for a reason that I'm about to get to. But the standard model, in principle, could either live in the bulk or in the IR. And in both are perfectly consistent. And it just gives you different different theories based on this RS geometry. Okay. So next thing I want to get to is warping and the Higgs. And this picture comes in as a nice solution to the hierarchy problem, provided I confine the Higgs to the IR brain. So for now, I won't say where the rest of the standard model lives, and we'll consider different possibilities down the road, but at least we want to put the Higgs on the IR brain. So H is our usual Higgs field. And we're going to assume that it lives on the IR brain. So if we write our action for the Higgs, S sub H, we can write this in a consistent five-dimensional way as follows. With we put in our usual gravitational pieces, and then we put in pieces that are covariant with respect to the full metric. Okay, so I'm not worrying about covariant derivatives for now, but I'll come back to this in a second. Okay, so all I've done is written the Higgs effective, the effective Lagrangian for the Higgs in a way that's consistent with the full five-dimensional coordinate invariance, in that I'm contracting up the Lorentz indices of the Higgs with g mu nu. Because the Higgs lives on a four-dimensional surface, I only have to worry about four-dimensional indices. It's covariant in the sense we have this square root g factor, and we're contracting up the indices with this 5D metric. We have some potential for the Higgs, and then this delta function just forces the Higgs to live in the IR brain. So actually, I guess I could have also written a full 5D derivatives and 5D metric here, but since the Higgs doesn't have any extend into the fifth dimension, the d5s would zero, would vanish. So in other words, the derivatives in the fifth dimension would go to zero. So this is this is a coordinate invariant expression. It gives the Higgs, and it forces the Higgs to live in the IR brain. And if we take our background metric and plug it in here, remember that this G is the determinant of the metric. So G is a shorthand for the determinant of the metric. And if I take the determinant of the metric, I'm going to have e to the minus 2kw, and I get four factors. Times 1. So I get a 1 from the dw piece. So this is my g. And then I take the square root. So this is going to become an e to the minus 4kw. I can do the dw integral with the delta function and get rid of that. So simplifying all this, I have a d4x. I get rid of this. My g becomes an e to the minus 4 kw. And then this g mu nu is the inverse metric. So my g mu nu is the inverse metric, which is just e to the plus 2 kw eta mu nu dx mu minus dw squared. So from this piece, I get an e to the minus 4 kw. From here, on the kinetic term, I get an e to the plus 2. Oh, so actually, instead of w, it should be a pi rc, because I'm living on the IR brain. Sorry. And then the rest of the structure is just the usual four-dimensional case. So I've reduced this to an eta mu nu, and I factored out the extra pieces. So I just rewrite this as the usual four-dimensional expression. Yes.
So the definition of the determinant, should that be gmn or g mu nu? Do you mean the four-dimensional part of the?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right.
And sorry. Also, where are we putting the cosmological constant in gravitational or in the standard model? Or should it be in the gravitational action?
Okay. So in principle, it would appear in the gravitational action. But it wouldn't affect the gravity term. It would just be a source term. So it'd just be another source in the gravity piece. So there'd be a source in the full action, with one part of the source being the bulk cosmological term, and the other source being the brain tensions. But as far as the gravity story goes, that's the whole story. Okay. But in any case, we've reduced this to something that looks like a regular four-dimensional theory, but we have these extra exponential factors. And with these extra exponential factors, we see that we have a non-canonical kinetic term. And what we always want for a kinetic term is to canonically normalize it, because this means that our propagators have the normal normalization in that case. So to normalize this canonically, let's change variables. And we're going to change variables to what I'll call h tilde. And I'll tell you what this is in a second. Let's see. So H tilde, or H, is going to be e to the pi krc h tilde, because if I rewrite h in terms of h tilde, these extra factors of the exponential cancel off these factors here. And I get back a canonical kinetic term. So this is just a change of variables. And it's a change of variables that transports me to, that gives me canonical kinetic terms. So OK, so I haven't done anything fancy. I've just changed variables into a more convenient form. Nice box. But now, if I go and look at my potential in terms of this so-called warp variable, it's going to take an interesting form. So now this H tilde is what we're going to identify with the regular Higgs field because it has a nice canonical normalization. And this potential, though, is going to change its form. So let's go and look at the potential. So if you write our V of H, a typical Higgs potential is going to have the form of, actually a bit of a typo there, minus mu squared H squared plus lambda over 2 H to the fourth. So this is just a standard Higgs potential. But now we want to rewrite our potential in terms of this new H tilde variable, and then multiply it by e to the minus 4 pi krc. So this implies that e to the minus 4 pi krc, v of e to the pi krc h tilde, when I plug all this stuff in, what I find is minus mu squared e to the minus 2 pi krc altogether h tilde squared plus lambda over 2 h tilde to the fourth. So what ends up happening is the rescaling that I apply to here in this piece is canceled off by this exactly, but the dimensional piece doesn't cancel off exactly, and I get an extra so-called warp factor here. And in principle, and you can show this more generally, the rescaling of any coupling in the potential or in the action is proportional to its mass dimension. So this lambda has mass dimension 0, so it doesn't get rescaled. The mu has mass dimension 1, and I square that, so that gets rescaled by 2 powers. If I had, let's say, a trilinear piece with mass dimension 1, it would get one factor of e to the minus pi krc. If I had higher dimensional operators, those would also get rescaled as well. Now, in any case, this is my story, and this is what I identify as my physical Higgs potential as a function of H tilde. So H tilde is my physical Higgs field, and this is my physical Higgs potential after all this rescaling. And what I see is that the quadratic term for the Higgs gets this exponential rescaling. So based on naturalness, what we would expect is that mu is just some dimensional thing in the theory, should be close to the size of the largest dimensional scale around, which we kind of naively expect it to be on the order of the cutoff m star. But the effect of mu that we get in our low energy theory that corresponds to what we see for the weak scale corresponds to m star, corresponds to this so-called fundamental mu times e to the minus pi krc. Now, we saw above that m star is roughly on the order of the Planck scale, up to order 1 factors. But this mu effective thing, we want to be near the TeV scale. And to get this near the TeV scale, or 100 GeV scale, we can achieve this provided pi krc is big enough. And numerically, this corresponds to the combination krc to be somewhere between 11 and 12. So this gives a this picture with the Higgs on the IR brain gives a new way to address the hierarchy problem, in that the warp factor comes in and it takes all dimensionful scales defined on the in this case on the IR brain, and it warps them down to much lower values. And these values can be as low as a TeV, provided the so-called warp factor is big enough. And okay, I may or may not have time to get into this, but there are also nice consistent ways to get this geometry with these two brains separated by a factor of krc of about 10 or 11. So these mechanisms are called moduli stabilization. It turns out that if I just looked at fluctuations of this metric without putting it in anything else, there are fluctuations of the brain distances. And these fluctuations of brain distances don't cost any energy. And this corresponds to metric fluctuations in the fifth component that would correspond to the radion field. So we mentioned the radion field yesterday for large extra dimensions. The same story applies here. And at this level, the radion is massless. But it turns out that there are ways to put in extra stuff within the bulk such that the radion gets a mass, and these two brain separations are fixed at values of KRC of about 11 or 12. So this story gives a nice way to address the hierarchy problem. And it looks very different from what we've seen before. So it looks very different from, obviously, supersymmetry. It also, at this level, looks very different from the technicolor theories you mentioned. We'll come back and relate this to a certain kind of technicolor theory down the road. Okay. In any case, this is the RS setup, the RS spacetime, and it's this warp factor that lets the natural Higgs scale be much less than the apparent fundamental scale. Just one more comment. Suppose I added a higher dimensional operator in here. So I could imagine thinking of this as an effective theory where I have some new, where, for example, I might have a new operator of the form h to the sixth suppressed by some new large mass scale. So it turns out that if you plug this in and change variables, this thing would transform into 1 to the m nu, e to the minus pi krc squared, h to the sixth. So the other thing that gets warped is the scale of higher dimensional operators. So the natural scale for these higher dimensional operators is also set by the fundamental Planck scale, just based on naturalness. And we see that these other higher dimensional operators also get warped down. So on top of everything else, for stuff that lives on the IR brain, there's a sense in which it's an effective field theory. It's only valid at energies not too much larger than the fundamental scale at the IR scale. So in other words, if I live on the IR brain, the apparent local cutoff is also warped down. And the apparent and the effective cutoff near the IR brain is also not that much bigger than a TeV. So this seems a little bit counterintuitive, because it seems like my fundamental scale is near the Planck scale. But it turns out that because of this warping, in some sense, our picture of local energy scales depends on where we sit in the extra dimension. So it turns out you can show that if you live near the UV brain, the local cutoff is near the fundamental gravity scale, m star. Whereas as I move farther and farther down the bulk towards the IR brain, my cutoff gets warped down to smaller and smaller values as well. So there's also a sense that what I think of as a natural energy scale changes as I go down the bulk. OK, now I'll try to make this a little bit more precise a bit later.
Why do you say this model solved the hierarchy problem? Is it because new effective is small even though new is large originally?
Yep.
So is the Higgs mass is originally, like, if I calculate Higgs mass, then is Higgs mass near the Planck scale?
No, I mean, you use this physical Higgs potential with those parameters, and you use that to compute the Higgs mass. And because the Higgs mass parameter is warped down to near TeV, the Higgs mass is expected to be near TeV. Okay, so this is a warp setup. So what I want to do next is start putting in fields in the bulk, and look at how the KK expansion of those fields goes. So there are different ways to put the standard model in the RS picture. As I said before, one picture has everything in the standard model on the IR brain, but gravity still propagates in the bulk. And in that case, the new states beyond the standard model are going to be the graviton KK excitations. On the other hand, another realization of RS models has the whole standard model in the bulk except for the Higgs. It still lives on the UV brain. And for that, all the standard model fields will also have new KK excitations. So let me start off by talking about KK excitations for boson fields. I'll say something about fermion fields a bit later. And just to start off, I'm going to start off by talking about vector bosons, essentially U1 gauge fields in the bulk, because those turn out to be, in a way, the easiest ones to deal with. And then I'll come back and apply it to gravitons. Okay. So to talk about KK excitations, though, I want to make a change of variables. So the change of variables I want to make is going to get rid of the exponentials. So the exponentials are nice for seeing big warpings, but they're not so nice when you want to solve differential equations. So I'm going to define a new coordinate z to be 1 over k e to the kw. So let me just warn you that this z is not the usual 3 plus 1 dimensional z. There's a bit of an abusive notation. This z refers to the distance in the extra dimension. So this z is not the same as what we call x3. So just to warn you, it doesn't have anything to do with what we often call z or z. So we have this. And we're going to allow this coordinate to live between L0 and L1. So this makes sense in that this L0 is going to match up with W equals to 0. So this L0 corresponds to K inverse, the inverse curvature scale. And this L1 is going to correspond to Z of being is going to correspond to W is pi kr, and this thing is going to be k inverse e to the pi krc. So in other words, I have a big ratio between the two values of the boundary of z of e to the pi krc. And remember, krc we want to be kind of order 11. So you should think of L1 as being very big and L1 as being very small in a relative sense. OK, and the reason this is a nice change of variables is that if I look at the metric written in terms of this new set of variables, what I find is that it has a property that we call conformal flatness, which is just, which I can rewrite as just a position-dependent rescaling. Oops. I can rewrite this as just a position-dependent rescaling of a flat five-dimensional metric. So we say this is conformally flat in the sense that this thing is flat, but it has a position-dependent scale factor. OK, and it turns out that this form is much easier to deal with than the exponential form.
What happened to the dz in the last one? Sorry, it's the exponential. Oh, and then, sorry. Yeah.
So here these m and n are running over all the indices, whereas this is just the zero. Okay, so I take this story, and I can, so I have this, and then in these coordinates, my gmn is, OK, I just wrote it down, L0 over z squared eta mn. And my inverse metric is and then my square root g in these coordinates is going to be the determinant of this. So the determinant of this is 1. Then I get 5 factors of this. Squared, square root, turns out to be just L0 over z to the fifth. So this is just a regular old change of variables, but it's a much easier, more convenient set of change of variables. OK, so now let's start off by looking at just a regular old abelian gauge field in 5 dimensions. And the Lagrangian for this is going to be d4x integral from L0 to L1 dz of the usual Lorentz covariant factor. And then we have a field strength of the form fmn FAB, where this FMN is DM AN minus DN AM, where AM is a five-dimensional vector field. And in principle, I should write these as gravity covariant derivatives, because I'm working in a curved spacetime. But the nice thing about the vector field, and this is kind of the reason why I started here, because this is an anti-symmetric combination, The extra gravity covariant pieces cancel out between these two pieces, because those end up being symmetric. And I'm just left with regular five-dimensional derivative without acting on here. OK. So for this, we also want to specify boundary conditions on the UV and IR brains. And the reason for boundary conditions is, at least if we think about this as a classical theory, we want to get equations of motion by varying the action with respect to small fluctuations in the field and finding where those variations are stationary. And if you think about varying fields in an action, what you typically do is vary the fields and then integrate by parts to move derivatives around. But when you integrate by parts, normally we assume that stuff vanishes on the boundary here. But we also want to make sure that these boundary terms that you get from integrating by parts also vanish on these boundaries. And a consistent choice for that is that we're going to apply so-called Neumann boundary conditions, which correspond to the derivative, the normal derivative at each boundary. So this is, if you recall, a Neumann boundary condition. And another potential choice is a Dirichlet boundary condition, in which I just force the fields themselves to vanish at the boundaries. It turns out that to get back fields that we can identify with standard model gauge fields, we're going to want Neumann boundary conditions. OK, so we have our action. We're assuming these boundary conditions at the UV and the IR brains at L0 and L1. And there's one more aspect that I want to mention before trying to solve things. And that is that this theory has a gauge invariance. Under AM goes to AM minus 1 over G del M alpha, where alpha is a gauge transformation parameter. So this is just a usual five-dimensional generalization of the four-dimensional gauge invariance. And we can use this gauge freedom to simplify our lives. And at least for what I want to do, I'm going to choose what's called a unitary gauge. And I'm going to choose a gauge such that I choose my alpha such that the fifth component of AM vanishes. So this is something I can always do within this amount of gauge freedom. So this is nice at tree level. It's not so nice at loop level, but we're going to focus on tree level, and this simplifies our life. So what this means is that if I look at the non-zero components of FMN, recall that this is an anti-symmetric combination. So my non-zero components will correspond to the F mu nu components, the usual ones. And then I could also have an F mu z. And the F mu z, where z corresponds to n, being the fifth dimensional coordinate, just reduces down to minus dz a mu. So these are my only non-zero components of FMN up to rescaling. And then there's no del mu a5 or del mu az because of this condition. So yeah, so I should say that sometimes I'll write this as A5, sometimes I might write it as A sub Z. But okay. In any case, I take this, I plug it back in to my action, I integrate by parts in the usual way, and I apply the boundary conditions. And what I get at the end of the day from this whole story is my action turns into the following form. The 1/2. Integral d4x, integral L0 to L1 dz. I get an A alpha, A mu nu, del squared, minus del mu, del nu, A beta, A alpha mu, A beta nu. OK. Actually, I forgot a factor. OK, sorry. I should have an L0 over z factor here. And then big bracket. And then I have a minus z over L0, A mu, del Z, L0 over Z, del Z, A nu, A to mu nu, and then big bracket. This is a little bit messy, but this is the full story. So I integrate by parts. And when I integrate by parts, for the mu and the nu components, the integration by parts just gives me the usual bilinear term for vector fields. So this is the thing you always get in four dimensions. I do have this extra L0 over Z factor. And that L0 over Z factor comes from the fact that this thing is going to give me L0 over Z to the fifth, whereas each of these G factors are going to give me Z over L0 squared each. And I'm left with one factor left over of L0 over Z. This is the usual piece. And this is a new piece. And this new piece comes from expanding out these field strengths and integrating by parts. But when I integrate by parts, because I have this L0 over Z factor, when I integrate by parts, I get a minus sign, and I get my del Z piece acting on this thing here. And then this piece corresponds to the piece that I would have here, but I factor that out and put that into canceled.
Why is the entire action 0 if I said L0 to 0? Does it make sense? I mean, it seems pretty random. It's an overall factor of L0 by Z. Because the L0 drops out in the second piece.
Sorry. The L0 goes to 0 isn't well defined from this point of view. So L0 goes to 0 means that my W goes to minus infinity, which is going outside of the space. So L0 here is necessarily non-zero, and L0 going to 0 is it's departing from my original setup.
It just means I cannot have this IR band being infinitely far away from the UV brain.
It's more that this is a bad choice of coordinates for L0 going to 0. So okay, it's just a bad coordinate change. I feel like it's a singular coordinate change as L0 goes to 0. So for now, let's stick with non-zero L0 and. Okay. In any case, we want to take this, and we want to KK expand. But the KK expansion now is a little bit more difficult. What we're going to want to do is find a KK expansion for A mu of the form A mu of X and Z is sum over KK modes A mu N of X times KK mode profiles Fn of Z. And we want to choose these Fn's such that everything diagonalizes. And if we think about trying to diagonalize this piece will diagonalize nicely provided these Fn's are orthogonal with respect to this inner product. So in particular, to diagonalize this piece, we want to make sure that the integral from L0 over Z of Fn of Z Fm of Z is delta Mn. Because if I have that and I plug it in here and do this expansion, this will separate into a set of independent KK modes. So this thing looks a little bit funny, but it's still a consistent inner product. But it's a consistent inner product with a non-trivial weight. So I can think of these as basis vectors defined with respect to an inner product defined by this, where the inner product of two functions is the product integrated with this weight function, or measure, if you like. But we also, so we can make this piece diagonal, provided we have this orthogonality condition, but we also want to make this piece diagonal. And to make this piece diagonal, we want to choose these Fn's to satisfy a certain differential equation. And that differential equation corresponds to, I'm running out of space, but I'll go over here. That differential equation corresponds to dFn is equal to minus mn squared fn, where this d is a differential operator, z over L0, del z, L0 over z, del z, acting on stuff. So if I have this form, I see that this particular differential operator d is coming in precisely here. And if this differential operator comes in and acts on a nu in the form of an expansion in terms of these fn's, and these fn's are eigenfunctions of this differential operator, it will turn this piece into just an eigenvalue for each mode. And then I apply orthogonality, and this will this piece is going to diagonalize as well, with each kk mode coming in with the particular eigenvalue mn squared. So it turns out that this differential operator plus this inner product has the form of a so-called Sturm-Liouville theorem, or Sturm-Liouville form. And there's a corresponding theorem that states that the eigenfunctions of a certain class of differential operators, second-order differential operators, are orthogonal, or are mutually orthogonal and form a complete basis on a function space defined with respect to a given inner product. And it turns out this is the relevant inner product. So it turns out that by the Sturm-Liouville theorem, we're guaranteed that the set of eigenfunctions is a basis for any possible function defined on the interval, subject to the boundary conditions. And that means that this KK expansion is self-consistent, in that if these are a complete basis of functions, I can always expand any function of Z this way. So I have this Sturm-Liouville result. This is just a generalization of what you essentially use all the time in separation of variables or quantum mechanics. And when I apply this separation of variables and I plug it back in here, my action turns into just a sum over kk modes. So I plug this back in here. I do the dz integral. What I get is a sum over n a alpha of n of a to mu nu del squared minus del mu del nu plus mn squared a beta of n a to mu alpha a to nu beta. So what I've done is just a KK expansion. A KK expansion in a slightly more complicated form than a flat space case. Instead of using the exponentials, which were corresponded to just the eigenfunctions of the del squared operator, we have a more complicated differential operator here in the fifth dimension. And we do our expansion, get this out, and this is the usual 4D vector boson piece. And this is obviously the KK mass. So given the structure, we see that we've reduced our theory to a sum over KK modes. And okay, I guess I'm out of time today, but tomorrow I'll come back and we'll show you what the explicit solutions are to this, figure out what the KK masses are, and show that we can get back, at least with Neumann boundary conditions, a zero mode state, a state with zero KK mass that we can identify with a massless four-dimensional vector boson. So, all right.